financial independence, country shopping, van nomadism, security culture, ethical enclaves, crypto anarchy, legal interstices, survivalism. Join your hosts, Shane and Kyle, as they explore this freedom strategy known as Vonage. You're listening to the Vonage Podcast.
And welcome to the Vonage Podcast, the podcast making you invulnerable to coercion. I'm Shane and...
I'm Jason.
Since governments are the primary coercers upon individuals, this podcast and everything found on the website is covered by BIPCOT, no government license. This allows reuse and modification to anyone, except for governments and the bludgies thereof. You can learn more at BIPCOT.org. Real quick, I figured I'd go ahead and toss this out there for the listeners of TVP. I do have Liberty Under Attack Direct Action Over Political Crusading shirts for sale. I've got them $15, free shipping. I'll send you some other free goodies, too. If you want to take a look at them, just go to libertyunderattack.com/shirts. That's shirts plural, libertyunderattack.com/shirts. Take a look at them. We accept cryptocurrencies, PayPal, all that good stuff. Trying to get rid of these. I have, I think, small, large, and extra large available. So if you're interested, definitely go check those out, libertyunderattack.com/shirts. So welcome back, Jason. It's a pleasure to chat with you as always. I always enjoy our discussions. So how are things going?
It could be better, Shane, but not bad. How are you doing this evening?
I feel like I feel like I'm kind of going through deja vu right now, but things are going great, I guess is the best way to put it. So I told you last week that I got a new job, for a sales position. And I was really happy about that. Great money making potential, but I applied as an electrician apprentice about a month and a half ago. And this company occasionally will hire people that have no experience whatsoever. So I put in the application and just kind of waited. And on last Friday, and this is being recorded on October 25th, last Friday I got a call for an interview. And I went in for an interview on Tuesday morning, and turns out I got the job. So I'll be making over $20 an hour as an electrician's apprentice. So that's what I've wanted to do the whole time, man. I mean, I took shop class in high school, and I really love that hands-on sort of thing. I was going to do welding. I was going to, go into a trade, but my parents kind of forced me into high-level indoctrination. They didn't force me, but, they said they would pay for it, and they said, you need to go to college, Shane. So I said, okay, fine. And I guess things are kind of coming full circle, and I'm really, really excited. Rather than pursuing a bullshit journalism degree, I'm really excited for this, man. An electrician skill is a great thing to have.
Oh, absolutely. It's not only is it a great thing to have, but it is very universal. It is a pre and post SHTF type of occupation also. So you can trade it, you can teach people it, you can do work for people and all that good stuff for, fiat currency, for silver, gold, crypto, whatever. It's a very fantastic occupation, and is very, very wide ranging. There's a lot of things that you could get into knowing how to do electrical work.
Right. And I mean, yeah, as you said, people always need electricians, and people always need electrical work done. I'm really, really excited about that. Crazy, man. I guess, the past year and a half or 2 years haven't been rough. I mean, I've been fine, but my financial situation has been kind of up in the air. But in the past couple of months, things have kind of turned around. I made $300 in sales today and commissions, which is absolutely nuts. I would keep doing that. Maybe I'll keep doing that on the weekends. It's a contract job, so maybe I'll do that, on Saturday and do a couple appointments and make a couple extra $100. But free health insurance with this new job too. Free health insurance. So I'm so making, having type 1 diabetes and how expensive that is. That's definitely, a bump in the pay, in the hourly pay pay grade.
Oh, it sounds like a fantastic opportunity, and there's so much room to grow, because the turnover of jobs like electrical or mechanical or things like that that are very hands-on, the turnover is very great, because a lot of people, they get into it and then they fade very fast. But if you can get into it and just keep doing, like if you said this is what you wanted to do, you wanted to be hands-on, you get into it and you keep going and you diversify your knowledge. Like if you get into knowing how to do solar panels and setting up all the equipment necessary for that, and then, you know, industrial and then housing and how to repair and just troubleshoot and things like that, it's the sky's the limit, man.
It is, and I guess I really hadn't thought of it that way. I've been thinking mostly about, God, my financial situation is finally going to, you know, stabilize, which it's always great, right? That was kind of the narrow-sighted approach that I had. But, I mean, yeah, you're exactly right. If, you know, once I start to learn this, I mean, I could, you know, I could probably, you know, do the electrical for my off-grid setup there at the homestead. So, and I wouldn't be able to do that now. I'd probably have to pay to outsource that. But, you know, with this job, I might be able to, or I'll likely be able to do that all myself. So, man, it's fantastic. It's fantastic.
Yeah, not only be able to like to do the electrical for your cabin and whatnot, but knowing electrical, knowing amps and ohms and resistance and gauges of wires and all that, you can troubleshoot, right? So if your chainsaw has a short, you can diagnose it and figure it out, right? If the tractor has a short, if your vehicle goes down, like you can troubleshoot these things if you know the basics of how they work. And when you have electrical, right, it's a huge benefit to know just even the very basics of these things so that you can fix it yourself and not have to, you know, hire out somebody for $100 to, you know, to fix a 2-minute issue.
Right. I hadn't really thought of this until now, but you mentioned ohms. And back when I was in high school, I was really into subs, you know, subs for my vehicle. I guess I do have at least a little electrical experience because I did mine, and I probably did setups for 10 other friends, you know, with the amplifier. So I guess it might be a little different, but I guess, you know, I have some experience with ohms. I actually know, like, I can actually understand that. So whatever. So Jason, you mentioned, I'm always curious as to, you know, what people are I guess, digging into, but, you mentioned you were reading before we started recording. What you reading?
I was actually reading a dystopian fantasy, series called 299 Days. It's a post-economic collapse in the Northwest. It's kind of statist, right? They're like, oh, the Constitution and this and that, but it's a pretty good read. It's got me thinking, got my wheels turning.
Very good. Right now I'm digging into, let's see, I guess I'm digging into a few different things. I'm reading Thomas DiLorenzo, I think is the author, The Real Lincoln. I'm reading that one, and I just started a couple nights ago, Tragedy and Hope by Carol Quigley. I've heard that for some reason, it's really crazy how this works out, but there are things that I, you know, never hear about, or I've never heard of before, say like a week ago. And then like I listened to 4 or 5 different podcasts and that's brought up. And that's how it was with Tragedy and Hope. And I said, okay, I need to read this, damn it. It's crazy how that kind of happens. You know, I've never heard of some concept, some book or something along those lines. And like in 1 week, I hear it like 1,000 times. I don't know why that happens. I really don't, but I guess I take it as a sign. Like, okay, I need to read this book, I guess.
The universe provides, Shane. Just don't question it. Just accept it. You're supposed to read that book for some reason.
I guess. So those are the two I'm digging into right now. Go ahead.
I haven't cracked into it yet, but my podcast mate Dan brought up General Smedley Butler's book, War is a Racket, on Sunday night. And then yesterday, just out of the blue, I happened to find a PDF link to the book. So I'm going to crack that one open once we get off the air tonight.
Right on. Good deal. Prof CJ, you know, the Dangerous History podcast, he actually has his students read that, which I think is just fucking fantastic.
That's a hell of a book to read.
God, and he hasn't read Anatomy. I interviewed him 2016, 2015, I don't remember exactly, on Liberty Under Attack. And yeah, apparently he hasn't read that book and Anatomy of the State by Rothbard. I think it was that book. So like, that's just really badass. You know, these kids in high-level indoctrination are actually getting some semblance of truth. So I think that's pretty incredible. But you know, quite a digression. Let's go ahead and get into it. So after 2 intermission episodes on pursuing Venuans in South Chile and Antarctica, let's get back into the realm of possibilities. Specifically, we're going to discuss Cary Thornley's series, The Permanent Floating Voluntary Society, originally published in Innovator, July to December 1966, but republished in Ocean Freedom Notes, which you can get for free by visiting VonniePodcast.com/OFN. Now, if you do want to support us and purchase it on Amazon, you can do so by visiting tinyurl.com/boatfreedom. Again, tinyurl.com/boatfreedom. That'll take you through the affiliate link, and you can pick that up for $2.99, although I don't expect you to. I mean, it's out there for free. Why would you pay for it? But hell, you know, if you want a Kindle version or something, I mean, you can go pick it up there. So, Jason, this is honestly one of my favorite things to discuss, and listeners of the Vonnie podcast and even LUA know that for a fact. You know, pursuing venuance out on the open ocean. I really don't think there's, as far as a solution with like, if you really want to live, you know, in anarchism, like in, I guess, live without rulers, I guess, not conceptually, but I guess physically, there's really no better place than international waters. I mean, there really is no government. And I really do think a Vanu association of some sorts, or, you know, just a minimalist sailboating family, you know, I think all of those things are really, really possible. And I do think that I do think in our lifetime, I think whether out of necessity or, you know, just, you know, someone, you know, someone's goals of achieving, you know, personal freedom or invulnerability to coercion, I really do think we'll see some sort of a Vanu association on the water at some time in my lifetime. I don't think that's too far out of the realm of possibilities.
No, not at all. The technical aspects of it are very, very possible. You know, as for building your floating city and getting to it and being in international water and being able to not only survive but to thrive, it's extremely possible. Like and as you said, the likelihood of it happening is a lot greater than, you know, a quote anarchist country or us colonizing Mars or, you know, putting an iceberg on reef.
Or starting a lion family in South Chile.
Yeah. The permanent floating anarchist community or whatever you want to call it is just, it's very, very possible, and the possibility of it is very, very, very intriguing to me. And like I'm looking forward to this. We should just start digging into it.
Right. I want to make one other note before we, you know, I guess really get into the meat of this, but this is something that people are already doing. Whether it's you know, Status, or whether it's someone like what's her name, Suzanne Vanderkamp, she's called the Oceanpreneur. Whatever it is, I mean, there are already people pursuing minimal sailboating. There are already folks. I mean, I'm sure you've been out on a lake where there's Party Cove. I mean, there are already voluntary floating associations, even if it's just in the lake. And there are those out on the ocean too. I mean, there are boating clubs that you know, have that sort of voluntary you know, society, so to speak. So this is already happening. Like this happens. You know, even outright goddamn Status do this. So, I mean, like, this is so practical. It's not even funny. But again, I will add the caveat that for people, you know, living in the geographical location known as America, everyone knows how to drive a car. So the only real simpler solution would be van nomadism, because pursue minimal sailboating or a permanent floating voluntary society, there are some skills that need to be obtained that, you know, the normal American with a K just doesn't have, right? There's a little more of a natural barrier to entry, I guess some more knowledge that would need to be obtained.
There's a lot of. It's not you can't just turn the wheel and turn the boat and all this. 'Cause there's a lot of techniques that you need to know, right? How to survive, you know, small waves, big waves, currents, to read the wind, to you know, go in the right direction. It's as opposed to a car where you're just, you know, your foot's on the gas and you apply the brake when you want to slow down and you turn the wheel and you follow the yellow line. There's no yellow lines on the ocean. There's nothing like that. The technical aspects of sailing a boat are enormous compared to the simplicity of driving a vehicle.
Right. And I don't say that to dissuade folks. I mean, yeah, I mean, there are new people, you know, taking, I guess, setting sail for sunnier waters, as Rayo would say, every single day. But it's just, you know, it's I wouldn't imagine it'd be hard to learn, but it'd just be a new skill that you would have to learn. That's basically it. And Kerry Thornley will talk about a couple of options here in this article series. But before getting into those articles, we have to talk about Kerry Thornley, Jason. We have to talk about him first. He was a very interesting character, and I will say a bit of a nut job in my opinion. But damn it, did he know his boats? So let's take a moment to dive into a little libertarian history. And what I read here will probably, I guess, bring his credibility into question, at least to some extent. But I will say, just kind of my viewpoint on it. Even though these events took place after he wrote, or I guess before he wrote these articles, I do think he is he seems like a very intelligent individual when it comes to the topic matter of or the subject matter of our discussion today. So I'll be reading a couple of pages from Brian Doherty's Radicals for Capitalism, pages 328 to 329. Quote, "Innovator took an increasingly cranky tone as the decade wore on. What had once been merely one of its interests became the dominant one by 1968. It arose from Marshall, Tom Marshall of Rayo, his preform project. The actual plan to create the island nation faded soon enough, but their ideology, which came to be known as libertarian Zionism, remained. The idea that the only way to find freedom in this unfree world was to hide from or physically escape the eyes of the state. A libertarian is almost by definition an eccentric. These guys push the boundaries of mental utopianism with articles on designing a new, more rational alphabet. Some of the magazine's eccentricities can be understood by contemplating an eccentric who briefly edited Innovator. A graduate of Lefebvre's Freedom School named Kerry Thornley had moved back to Southern California and hooked up with Tom Marshall, eventually editing the zine. In the late 1950s in dull suburban Southern California, Thornley had helped his high school buddy, Greg Hill, invent the comedic religion of Discordianism. It was dedicated to the worship of Eris, the Greek goddess of chaos. Its flavor can be gleaned from the bit of a powerful magic, the Turkey Curse, from its holy book, the Principia Discordia." And I'm not going to read that, it's irrelevant. Skipping forward, Discordianism became the heart of the most influential libertarian novel since Atlas Shrugged, though its libertarianism is not always recognized by more economistic libertarian movement types, Robert Shea and Robert Anton Wilson's Illuminatus trilogy. Thornley had a storied past before hooking up with Marshall and the Innovator. He had joined the Marines in 1959, where one of his buddies at the El Toro Marine Base outside Santa Ana, California, was Private Lee Harvey Oswald, an openly communist outfit 8-ball known as Oswaldskovich, to his fellow grunts. Thornley began writing a novel based on his disillusioning experience in the Marines. After hearing that Oswaldskovich was really meant it with all that commie talk, he actually defected to the Soviet Union. Thornley transformed the novel, called The Idle Warriors, into a Roman eclef about Oswald, making Thornley the only person to write a book about Lee Oswald before he finally made good that fateful day in Dallas. Thornley was living in New Orleans when Kennedy was killed and hanging out, in his own recollections, which friends suspect might be largely invented, with a curious cast of characters including some unfortunates caught in New Orleans district attorney Jim Garrison's feckless late 1960s investigation into the supposed JFK murder conspiracy. It is definitely not Thornley's imagination that he was dragged into the public who killed Kennedy melodrama. Testifying before the Warren Commission and targeted himself by Garrison, who decided Thornley might have been part of the conspiracy as a second Oswald, since the two old Marine buddies allegedly looked frightfully similar, as well as because of a weird series of coincidences apparently linking them. While working with Innovator, Thornley also became an advocate of early free love cult Charista, which neo-pagan historian Margaret Adler credits as the true beginnings of the neo-pagan movement in contemporary culture. He was simultaneously hanging around with ultra-right anti-commie quasi-revolutionaries, the Minutemen. Through the 1970s and 1980s, the phony order of insanely elaborated conspiracy theories won Thornley's heart away from Eris, losing him most of his old friends. No one wants to hang with someone who takes you for a government agent, part of a Baroque conspiracy against him. Thornley had decided that District Attorney Garrison was right after all, that he was a CIA mind-controlled slave, that a mysterious pal in New Orleans was really E. Howard Hunt, and finally that he had been a Manchurian candidate from birth, with his parents undercover Nazi spies. He spent the last decade or so of his life, he died in 1998, occasionally washing dishes for a living and skulking about in storm drains, hanging out as a neighborhood eccentric in Atlanta's Little Five Points neighborhood. A pathetic fate, perhaps, but Thornley still had his heuristic fun. When the Super Bowl was held in Atlanta in 1994, he put up flyers urging, "Boycott the illegal weapons amnesty program. Don't bring your illegal weapons to the Super Bowl in exchange for tickets," end quote. So there it is. So this is this individual, you know, Kerry Thornley, who was an editor for Innovator and a colleague of Rayo's, Tom Marshall. And, you know, he was, you know, I guess he was brought into the Warren Commission's investigation, and he was friends with Lee Harvey Oswald, or I guess associates, or I guess military buddies, or whatever, whatever I guess the label, you know, put on it. But what an interesting guy.
you can't make that up. I mean, this guy is like, I don't want to say he's Looney Tunes, because he's not. He's totally not. He's a very intelligent person, but... like, just what a happenstance, man. Just like the coincidence of him being buddies with Lee Harvey Oswald and all this other stuff is just like, damn. Oh, man, the poor guy.
Yeah, it's certainly interesting. And that is a little, I guess, a little known piece of libertarian history. But then again, a lot of folks haven't really heard of Rayo or Innovator a lot more now that, you know, Kyle, when Kyle and I, you know, made a lot of this stuff public. But, or I guess, brought, like, I guess, brought it back from the dead, so to speak. But still, it's so interesting. And he was very much into direct action, at least in the 60s. Keep in mind, this was originally published in 1966, in 1966 issues of Innovators. So obviously, the JFK assassination. I think it's November 21st, 1963. I think that's it.
I believe so.
So yeah, this is a few years after that. So, I guess to take that into consideration, just I guess a little background on the individual we're going to be individual's words we're going to be reading today. So let's get into it. Chapter 1, Small Boats. What's the use of being a shipmaster if you can't tell people to go to hell? An old captain's proverb. Quote, the greater portion of this planet's surface is out of the effective control of any state, and yet libertarians complain that for the man who would be free, there is no place to go. This article is the first of a series dedicated to an exploration of the ocean interstice as a means to personal liberty and economic freedom. Small boats. Quote, for as low as the price of a late model car, an individual can purchase a seaworthy vessel large enough for a small family. This writer is acquainted with a couple who bought a used 26-foot yacht for somewhere around $500 and lived aboard with their small daughter, sailing the Pacific for a year. Since these folks were not averse to a steady diet of fresh seafood, expenses were quite low. For, as the man of the family, he pointed out, there was no place to spend money out there. And on a previous voyage to the Virgin Islands, they had stocked up on rum at $1.25 a gallon. For the less adventurous, a slightly larger investment will fill the galley with dry land staples. And for those who want to get grim about investing money on a boat, it is no problem to spend over $30,000 for a fancy yacht. But suitable used, or brand new, boats can be had for much less. You can save yourself time by first getting some book learning, particularly with regard to sailing terminology, a small language in itself, very important for conversing with instructors and other sailors. After you learn the difference between a jib and jibe, you learn the origin of such colorful terms in everyday English as landfall, leeway, tack, bilge, and mainstay, you are ready to take a course in theoretical sailing and or small boat safety. Such courses are given gratis by the U.S. Power Squadrons, which comprise a national private organization dedicated to on-the-water safety. And for libertarians who don't mind sanctioning the state, both the U.S. Coast Guard and many public adult night schools offer similar instruction. The next step is to go out on the water under the supervision of a competent sailor. The market rate for such practical lessons at this time in Southern California is around $10 an hour, including boat rental, and worth every penny of it. 6 hours of such supervised sailing ought to make you about ready to go at it alone. For gradually lengthening trial runs, during which you can teach yourself to navigate, with the help of any good advanced sailing manual. By this time, if you have not been doing so before, you will probably be keeping an eye out for that special boat that fits you. A sailing vessel with a motor of some kind is probably the best bet for exploring the ocean interstice on a small scale, combining fuel economy with flexibility. There are boats made of steel, fiberglass, and wood. Some are built for speed and others for cruising. You'll be learning more about the choice of a boat for yourself in the process of becoming seaworthy. Meanwhile, the steps outlined above will help you get your rudder wet. End quote, Kerry Thornley. So yeah, I think the most important first point, and this is something I think we pointed out in the minimalist sailboating episode, which I'll link in the show notes. That's bonniepodcast.com/intermission. I think it's 11. Whoops. Yeah, intermission 11. But I mean, so yeah, you can spend as like there are very, you know, whether it's van nomadism or whether it's minimalist sailboating. I mean, hell, you know, there are a lot of used boats out in Houston and in Florida that you could probably pick up for very cheap. And I saw quite a few images where, you know, the water rose enough to where the boats, you know, became undocked and just like slid into the middle of an intersection. I'm sure you could get those. Like, they're just kind of some cosmetic damage probably, and you know, some little things that might need to be done. But generally speaking, I'm sure you could pick those up at a very cheap price. So the point is, you can spend as little or as much as you want on a boat, just as you could spend as little or as much as you want on a van conversion. So regardless of what your, I guess, your preferences are and your budget, you know, this is very feasible.
Oh, very, very much so. It's not as he said here, about the price of a late model sedan, blah, 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 blah. Absolutely. Absolutely. For a couple $1,000s, you can get a boat that is livable, right? You can get a larger boat with a little bit of damage and then throw in some elbow grease and fix it up. Fixing up the boat will also allow you to get to know the boat, which is a huge deal, because you don't want to, your first time out sailing, you jumping in the water, you don't want to, you know, you don't want to jump in the Cadillac of boats and then go back and try to navigate your Pinto of a boat, right? You want to learn to navigate your boat so that you can learn its intricacies and its quirks and its little habits, and you want to learn how to drive your boat, right? You don't want to learn on anybody else's boat. And yeah, as you said, Houston and Florida, right? Hurricane country. When those boats, you know, they get knocked up on land, right? The cost to move them plus the cost of to repair them, are they like the insurance companies will take those numbers, and if it's worth more than the boat, they'll call the boat trash and just cut the owner a check. And then you can buy those boats for very cheap from salvage yards or from tow yards, things like that.
Right, right. And I will point the listeners in the direction of the Going Mobile publication, which I think I just released that, you know, this past week. But there's a really good, article on there on I guess acquiring, you know, a sailboat. And one of the suggestions which I thought was kind of ingenious is, you know, kind of the boat storage yards. There are people who, you know, they store their boats and never come back and get them, which I think is really stupid, but it happens. And, you know, if it's sitting in storage long enough and, you know, the owner of the boatyard knows he's not going to get his storage fees, you know, he needs that space. What's he going to do? I mean, he might sell it to you for cheap, or he might just say, get this piece of shit out of my yard. Take it. So I think that's a really interesting, an interesting possibility. But yeah, I definitely refer you to goingmobilevanipodcast.com/GM. To check out, you know, all of those various options in detail. But I really do like the outline here that Carrie Thornley laid out. And I will say, whenever I was in high school, we had a boat for, maybe a year or two. And yeah, I mean, the U.S. Power Squadrons, I looked at probably when I was digitizing Ocean Freedom Notes. And the boating test, the initial one, that he recommended is one that I already took, and I have the permit or license for in order to be able to drive the boat. It's a bullshit easy test, but regardless, I mean, yeah, that I think that's a really good place to start. You know, reading books on and learning the terminology. I guess maybe getting your grammar work in. You know, acquiring that baseline information as per the Trivium method, and then you know, kind of move forward there. You know, a theoretical sailing and small boat safety. And then move on to, you know, actually going out with an experienced sailor, I guess a trainer, and then going from there. So I kind of like the progression, and it makes it seem less daunting, you know, kind of. So there are definitely some steps you can take if this is something you're wanting to pursue.
Oh yeah, to equate this to back to driving, as we talked about earlier, knowing the knowledge. I mean, that's the equivalent of reading the DMV book, right? And then you take the test and you get your quote learner's permit or whatever else, and then you go out with an instructor, right? I mean, this is your driver's permit. You go out with an instructor. You go out with somebody that knows how to drive, or in this case, knows how to handle the boat and how to sail it and all the intricacies that the book doesn't teach you. And then from there, you move on, and then you drive. I get that's as I forgot where I was going with that one.
no worries. Yeah, you know, I definitely get what you're saying. And I guess the last paragraph talks about, you know, kind of the type of boats. I guess the there are recommendations by folks. I think Rayo and a lot of Inuans recommended Trimarins because they were cheap and they worked, I guess. But there's really, what are the best boats? Well, it kind of depends upon what you're doing. Are you going to be solo? Are you going to be with a family? What are your goals? Are you trying to, cruise or are you, going to be smuggling illegal drugs on your boat and need something to go fast so you can, make more deliveries? I mean, it comes down to preference. I mean, value is subjective, as the great Mises taught us, showed us. So, I mean, I don't know a whole lot about boats. I will be interviewing on Liberty Under Attack. Let me actually get her name real quick, Jason. Suzanne Vanderveeken. And she's been living pretty much 95% of the time on the ocean for some time now. She wrote a new book, which I'm really excited to read. But I'll be interviewing her, and I'll try to get some of her recommendations on, what boats are out there, what ones are best for, say, cross-Atlantic traversing. What ones would be best for, various situations. So I'll try to get some answers there, but I don't have any specifics. So as I've said before, I mean, I have some idea when it comes to Van Nomadism because I've been driving for 10 years almost. But for boats, I did some boating on Clinton Lake here in central Illinois, when I was 16, 15 and 16. But I've never driven a boat on the ocean. I've never been out there, so... I don't have this information, so we got to go to folks that do have that information, right, Jason?
Oh, yeah. People with experience are very valuable tools.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, needless to say. Yeah, for sure. So I guess anything else you want to mention on the small boat section, chapter one?
No, I don't have any notes written or anything.
All right, so chapter two, large boats. Quote, I glance at the chronometer. I stare at the thin red lines. If only the shore world were regulated by force as logical, as honest, as the law of storms, end quote. Sterling Hayden. Large boats. A former political activist who decided to eliminate the middleman in his crusade for individual freedom, Bill Beer illustrates in the flesh the permanent floating voluntary society concept. The Beers' Bill, his wife, Sue, and their 3.5-year-old daughter, Barry, perform the combination host crew guide services of the new family occupation, charter sailing aboard the True Love, which starred as the major prop in the movie High Society, about half their days on the Caribbean. When they are not chartering or sailing on a busman's holiday, their boat is tied to the dock in Charlotte Amalie of the U.S. Virgin Islands. Here the Beers make repairs and mingle with the 20 or so other couples in the Virgin Island charter fleet. And I'll only quote there for a moment, because Jason, you did some, some background research on the boat, the True Love. So tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, not only on the boat, but on Bill also. Bill is a fantastic guy, right? I mean, he actually has a book out called We Swam the Grand Canyon. In 1955, fresh out of the Army, him and his buddy John Daggett swam 279 miles of the Colorado River. And why did they swim it? Because they couldn't afford a boat.
That's nuts. Wow.
Yeah.
Dude was probably jacked or in really good physical shape.
I would absolutely assume. But in 1965, they arrived in the Virgin Islands on the boat True Love. The boat was built in 1926. It is a John Aldeed Malbert VII schooner. And the boat is still in service, right? The boat still sails right now. It's owned by Schooner Excursions Incorporated in Watkins Glen, New York. You can actually see the boat at Seneca Harbor on Seneca Lake in New York. You can actually, you can rent the boat and they'll take you out on the tours. I think it holds 22 people or something like that.
And where did you say the boat was currently?
Seneca Harbor, Seneca Lake on Watkins Glen, New York.
Okay, New York. Okay, interesting. Anything else?
No, that's all I got for that one.
Cool. All right. Well, thank you for that information. So, yeah, a little background on the True Love. So, quote, the Beers acquired the capital necessary for setting up their new business by selling all of their property down to the TV set. Then they traveled to Connecticut where they purchased the True Love. At this time, Sue Beer had no sailing experience, and Bill had never owned a boat. They learned seamanship the hard way. Under the tutorage of a dense fog, a churning inlet, a sandbar, 200 miles of inlet waterway, and a storm in the Atlantic, in that order, on the trip down to the Caribbean. which prepared them for the successful navigation of the reef-strewn, poorly charted Bahamas archipelago when their motor blew up near the end of the voyage, end quote. So, now what they did to learn, you know, I really wouldn't recommend that. I think what Mr. Thornley laid out was, you know, a more logical and rational approach. But, you know, some individuals, you know, I guess that there might be some Vanuans who, you know, once they come across this idea, you know, as someone who I'm going to interview, actually, someone reached out to me, Jason, who's doing van nomadism in Australia. You know, I guess a listener and a reader. And I said, you want to come on for an interview? We were always looking for folks that are doing these things. And he said, yeah, for sure. So we're going to get that, you know, scheduled for sometime in November, which will be difficult considering they're in the middle of the forest, you know, in a van in Australia. So the time zone differences are not going to be the only obstacle, but we'll get it set up. But like for them, they just sold all their stuff, quit their jobs, and pursued van nomadism. So there are some of those folks that, you know, aren't going to get their toe wet. They're just going to dive in. And I guess that just comes with, you know, different personalities, different individuals, right? So I wouldn't recommend this specifically, but if this is you, I mean, you know, I think that's, you know, however you get to Vanu, I think is a good way to get there.
Oh, absolutely. If you can get yourself into a situation that limits the coercion you experience due to the state, some people will ease into it, and some people will just jump in with both feet, like Bill did, and like the guy in Australia did. They just, you know, poof, plunge. Vanu.
Right. Right. And, you know, I think that's fantastic, too. I mean, that's not the type of person that I am. It's just not. But yeah, I'm sure there are some folks.
No.
I like I like to learn. I like to plan. You know, that would kind of scare me a little bit. And plus, I mean, the ocean ain't nothing to screw with. It's not. I mean, I don't think it would. I mean, with modern day boats, sure, it'd probably be easier to survive. But at the same time, man, you get out there in international waters and you make a mistake.
Oh, yeah. I would, as much survivalism as I know it and things like that, I would be more scared to jump in a boat and go in the ocean far more than I would to grab a backpack and a few days of food and walk up into the woods.
Oh, exactly. I mean, when you go into the wilderness, I mean, sure, there might be some sort of some sort of fear at least, but at the same time, there are ways that there are, you know, plenty of ways to survive out in the woods, you know, foraging and you know, hunting and things like that. But if your boat goes down in the middle of the ocean, there's not a whole lot you can do, right? There's just not a whole lot of options. So yeah, I think that was a good thing to bring up as a comparison. You know, some folks maybe, you know, if they got dropped in the middle of the Siskiyou region, they might be a little scared, but you know, they'd have a lot better of a chance there than if they got dropped off a helicopter or thrown out of a helicopter, damn it, into the middle of the Pacific Ocean. I guess going back to that episode of the discussing the Alcaloop tribe in South Chile, but. Anyways, let's get back to it. Quote, but now Bill can say, we have a freedom and an independence matched by few, and the solid security of near self-sufficiency. We could ask no more. Charter sailing tourists in colorful parts of the world, as the Beers are doing, is a good way to make money while living at sea, but it is not the only way in which a large boat can serve as a tool of production. Simple freedom from police harassment for group activities, such as wild parties, clandestine political meetings, illegal medical operations, is a valuable condition which a boat captain can provide for a fee. In addition, he can run cargoes to out-of-the-way places on service by major shippers, provide transportation to escaping political refugees, and undertake speculative anti-state ventures, such as the smuggling of American cigarettes into Spain, where high tariffs make such operations, however dangerous, extremely profitable. Smuggling opportunities in a world of anti-libertarian trade policies, in fact, are legion. One can take diamonds out of Africa and South America, run arms to rebels in Cuba, land-used auto and refrigerator parts in Mexico, bring gold into certain near-totalitarian countries where ownership of some is unlawful, all for life, liberty, and property, end quote. So I want to stop there. I mean, that's something I've thought of, too. As far as money-making, you know, ventures, you're... The only risk you run is when you're up there on when you're in, out there on when you're, you know, going up to port. to some country's port. That's really the only risk that you run. If you're out in international waters, I mean, Kyle and I talked about, I think, in that minimal sailboating episode, if you find an uninhabited ocean island, you know, which the climate may be, I don't know how many of these exist, but just go, bear with me for a moment, Jason. If you find like an uninhabited ocean island where, you know, maybe the climate would be really good for growing marijuana, and you grow a shit ton of marijuana there, and then you just have boats that run that to different countries, or know, maybe the coast of the Pacific, maybe the California coast, something like that. Maybe California wouldn't be the best state since you wouldn't get as much for it there, but, you know, say New York or something like that. I don't know. But, I mean, there are some very good profit potential there, and you being the guy, you know, maybe growing the weed on the uninhabited ocean island, you would be, you know, you wouldn't be running much of a risk. I wouldn't think, unless I don't think you'd be at that much risk.
If you're the one, if you're like on the island actually growing, probably not. Because they'd have to find you, and then they'd have to come get you. And if you're out in the middle of nowhere, you know, if you're 1,000 miles off land or whatever, they're not gonna waste that on some cannabis. No way. True. But I mean,
true. There's the international drug smuggling thing, right? So that, like, I guess,
yeah.
So yeah, that might come into it a little bit there. But regardless, I mean, even something just as basic as, you know, American cigarettes into Spain or whatever. I mean, be creative, guys. I mean, I know there are entrepreneurs listening to this episode. I'm sure you can think of a billion ideas of making money out in the open ocean, legal or otherwise. So, just there are a lot of opportunities, man. There really are.
Oh, and there's an incredible amount of opportunity because there's so much. There's a lot of resources. First off, there's a lot of resources out on the ocean that you can find. And second to that, there are always people willing to use the black market, right? Where for almost every desire, there is a market solution. And if you have people that want cigarettes, you know, off in Spain or in Cuba, like if you have people in Cuba that are craving, you know, something from, you know, America, it's only 50 miles from Cuba to Florida. So you run up to Florida and you buy a bunch and then you drop them off in Cuba. It's the opportunities are very much there. If you're willing to take the risk, that's the whole point of this is freedom versus risk, right? It's coercion versus risk, just as with all the other Vanu, all the other Vanu outlets. It's the amount of risk that you're willing to take on, because the more risk you take on, the more susceptible you become to coercion.
Right.
You know,
right.
So it's risk versus reward. It's totally subjective. It's what you're willing to do.
Exactly. And that's why it's such high hopes for the Marinade Project, man. And it's on hiatus. I'm sure there could be some funder that, you know, comes in and funds it, but it is on hiatus now. But that's one of the reasons I, you know, had high hopes for Marinade, because once that initial, you know, $15 million for the flotel, the floating hotel, that barge that was repurposed into a hotel. I mean, it would have been, you know, in between Cuba, the Bahamas, and Florida. So kind of right in that little triangle. So, you know, where, like, just kind of as you were kind of mentioning, I mean, a very good place for a free port, a very good place. So, you know, it's a very high trafficked area, the KSL Bank is. So, you know, once that initial investment was there, I mean, the amount of opportunities for profit were almost endless. We're almost endless. So I don't know. I think Roger Ver and the Free Society Foundation should just buy that flotel and, you know, just, you know, kickstart Marinilla rather than, you know, risk buying land from a government or a nation state only to have the money only to have the drug dealer keep the money and the drugs as a kind of a metaphor there. So I think a metaphor. Yeah. But I mean, yeah, it's because that's as we're going to get into momentarily, that's going to be that's always the biggest issue is funding for libertarian projects.
There's no money in libertarian movement. Just the way it is. There's never any money. Like, and that's because we live in a world that is largely corporate controlled. You know, if you have law of money, you can buy favorable laws and all that good stuff. Libertarians aren't going to buy favorable laws. Right. So there's no incentive there to be a rich libertarian.
Right. And you know, I'm kind of envious of the libertarians back in you know, even from like the 1950s to maybe the 1980s, might get the years off a little bit there. But like there were probably, you know, maybe 3 to 5, you know, libertarian, you know, funding outlets, you know, that would, whether it be funding, you know, a publication, or whether it was, you know, funding a libertarian author while he wrote a book, or funding whatever project. I mean, there used to be some funding outlets, and now it's kind of, you know, relegated to the Koch brothers. And, you know, I don't see them, you know, investing in Marinier anytime soon, nor do I really want them to. That would not be, you know, good. but yeah, you know, there were some funding ventures, I guess some funding, that was given to libertarians, you know, in the mid 20th century, but that doesn't really exist anymore. It just doesn't.
No, back then people valued freedom.
Yeah. Yeah.
Seems like most people don't do that anymore.
No, and I'm sure there were some ulterior motives with some of those outlets. But regardless, I guess there's one more paragraph in this article in part two. So I'll just go ahead and read that real quick. Quote, large boats in short offer a way to liberty for those interested in economic as well as personal freedom, but who yet do not possess capital necessary for such permanent floating voluntary ventures as shipping lines or man-made islands, to be discussed in the future articles of this series. Carrie Thornley, end quote. So, I guess anything on that last one, or should we just go ahead and move forward? Because we kind of already covered that. I've already covered anything that I had to say.
No, let's just keep going.
Okay, chapter 3, ships and shipping. Quote, the term cheap flags refers to the three states, Panama, Liberia, and Honduras, which lend their flag indiscriminately to all ships provided the owners pay once a registration fee and a very low yearly registration tax. Apart from this, the ship owners sailing under the cheap flag are not subject to taxation. Furthermore, this freedom from taxes is guaranteed by the law of the same low level, at the same low level in Liberia for 20 and in Honduras for 30 years. It is most interesting that thus three small and underdeveloped states achieved foremost positions in the world shipping market in spite of the various obstructionist efforts by other states and competitors, end quotes from Peace Plans. So, I mean, what he's talking about there is flags of convenience. And that's something that's around today, obviously. There was I'm trying to remember exactly where I heard this from, but regardless, if flags of convenience are important, if you have a boat that is not flying a flag of convenience, or just you know, a flag of some country or nation state, you are considered a pirate, and you know, the governments will do with you what they do to pirates. So. It's unfortunate. I mean, it is legal interstice, but thankfully this is such a low fee legal interstice that it really doesn't matter. In my opinion, I think it's highly worth it. I think this is a legal interstice that Rayo would have, you know, said, hell yeah. I think this is a wise one. You know, you get that flag of convenience and you can go have your you know, permanent floating voluntary society in international waters, not have to deal with any government. So I don't know. What do you think?
I had to look it up real quick. Flag of convenience is a business practice whereby a merchant ship is registered in a country other than that of the ship's owner. Owners of a ship may register the ship under a flag of convenience to reduce operating costs or avoid the regulations of the owner's company. The closely related term open registry, which describes a ship register that will register foreign-owned ships, also exists. The term flag of convenience has been used since the 1950s, and it refers to the civil ensign a ship flies in order to indicate its country of registration or flag state. A ship operates under the laws of its flag state, and those laws are used if the ship is involved in a case under admiralty law. So basically, what it is, it's. I don't, for lack of a better term, it's a false flag, if you will, right? If you're American, it is a false flag, right? If you are an American, right, and you're running things that are illegal in America, but they're legal in Panama, Liberia, or Honduras, fly that flag, and then if you get caught, well, it's totally legal where, you know, I'm flying the flag of, right? It's totally legal where I'm, quote, from. Because I'm flying the flag of Panama, Liberia, or Honduras.
Exactly. So essentially, to put it another way, it's You know, it's a way to not be a pirate. I mean, you know, pirate life would be badass, sure. I mean, obviously, but the idea is you know, becoming as invulnerable to coercion as possible. And you know, pirates, you know, they do get their fair share of coercion from nation states when they're located, but or governments in general. So the idea here is, you know, with one of these countries where they just want the $30 a year fee or something like that. They just want that kind of revenue generation. I mean, that's what it is. I mean, it's admitted. I mean, that's why they're doing it.
That's exactly what it is. You're buying a certain level of freedom.
Yes. Yeah. You are. You definitely are. And I guess another thing here is with one of these countries where, you know, the flags and convenience come with very, you know, limited laws, you know, put forth on that. I don't know exactly. I don't have any examples off the top of my head, but yeah, I mean, you want one with, like, you know, fewest laws possible, you know, the fewest fees, the fewest taxes. So, I think that's a great way to go. I really do. You know, if I you know, set sail for sunnier waters tomorrow, yeah, I'd get a flag of convenience. You know, I think it's especially if you're, I mean, if you're going to be self sufficient out in international waters and hardly ever be seen by anybody or ever. Sure, you could go without one, but if you're going to be doing any importing and exporting, you know, going to ports and things, yeah, probably not, you know, not wise to not have that flag of convenience. It's almost like a driver's license, right? If you're going to be, you know, driving into San Francisco, you might want to have your plates and your driver's license and, you know, mandatory insurance if it is mandatory there. So
it is.
So, yeah, I mean, it's just kind of a way to, you know, make yourself more vulnerable to coercion and utilize that interstice to further your personal freedom.
Yes. Yeah, you're like I said, you're buying a certain level of freedom by flying this, quote, flag of convenience. And I love the idea. I absolutely do.
Right. And one other thing here is obviously, as Rayo said, you know, legal interstices are not to be relied upon. I mean, you know, they do get, you know, these legal loopholes get closed and all of that. Or, you know, say in America, like a passport would be a legal interstice. There could be a time in the future where, you know, the United States passport is suspended, right? Like there could be a time like that. So if you have a flag of convenience for the United States and, you know, for some reason in the future, you know, they suspend that or something, you're in a world of trouble. But if you get this, like, some smaller country that really doesn't give a shit, they just want the money, I mean, you're probably better off. I mean, you're probably better off, in my opinion.
Absolutely. I agree completely.
Okay, let's get to it. Ships and shipping. Quote, during the last century, no voice was louder in calling for government intervention than that of the American shipping industry. Not only did these shippers want subsidies in order to better compete with the subsidized lines of England, but they were quite willing to tolerate, and sometimes even encourage, trade tariffs as a means of enticing Congress to grant them privileged status. They got their intervention. Now American shipping is in an overall decline, and shippers are demanding increased subsidies in order to better compete with the non-subsidized cheap flag lines. If it has seriously occurred to any American ship owner that the industry's trouble is due to the expensive flag of tariffs, make work legal regulations, and yes, subsidies for other people and the resulting taxation, he is probably no longer an owner of an American registration-wise ship. For the most cheerful thing an American shipper can hope for besides a handout these days is a good and bloody full-scale war, end quote. So, just simply put, I mean, it's fascism. Fascism. That's what it is.
Taxation is theft, and if you can limit your theft, you're better off, right? I mean, this Henry Hazlitt's book Economics in One Lesson is a really, really great interplay to this, right? I mean, they're talking about needing subsidies, right, to compete with subsidized lands of another country and then better to compete against subsidized cheap flag lines, right? What they're talking about is profit, right? They want subsidies to increase their profits.
They want higher priced goods, yeah, and they want to probably have some sort of our artificial scarcity included in there too.
Oh, absolutely. They definitely want goods price protection and things like that.
Right. Yeah. So no surprise at all. I mean, this is
that's what big corporations do all the time.
Yes, and for the goddamn leftists who think that, you know, America just became fascist when Dolan J. Trump took office, you have been living under a rock, and I have no respect for you as an individual. There are a lot of reasons to despise any political ruler, but, yeah, whatever.
If they were economically and morally consistent, they wouldn't be leftists. They wouldn't be rightist either, so...
Exactly. Plenty of blame to go around. I just find that absolutely hilarious. You know, fascism just got to America. Oh, shut up. God. Okay, getting back to our quote. Keeping this in mind, along with the corollary that anyone in close sympathy with the policies of American shippers cannot be expected to have much understanding of economics. The interested libertarian will find the Principles of Ocean Transportation by James Vernon Metcalf, a professor of foreign trade at Seattle University, a very fine book. Chief among its virtues is its comprehensive yet relatively concise approach to a field that is usually written about in either a highly specialized manner or in a style so popular as to be superficial. The Principles of Ocean Transportation is the introductory book for the libertarian interested and taking advantage of the freedom of the high seas on a heavy industry level. It provides orientation in all aspects of operating merchant vessels. And it goes through the various chapters of the book. I'll just, you know, read a few here. The chapter titles include ship characteristics, admiralty and maritime law, labor relations, ocean shipping via canals, world fleets and ports, ocean freight rates, cargo documentation, etc., etc. To give you a brief idea here. Now, back to quoting. The prime consideration with regard to merchant shipping is capital. Unless you have or can raise several hundred thousand dollars, starting a shipping line is out of the question. Possibly a number of libertarian businessmen will form a company for precisely this reason. For no industry is less physically subject to state harassment, and therefore any better prospect for long-term investment than ocean transportation. Another possibility is for association of libertarians to form, each for the purpose of buying one ship, and for these associations to cooperate under a single company trademark. Each associate could represent a particular faction within the movement. Thus, one might envision a ship with a limited constitutional government, all of its own sailing beside one, without any government at all. And perhaps there would be an aircraft carrier called the Henry George, upon which the captain collected deck rents, while the sailors aboard the schooner Green Revolution experimented with farming at sea. The possibilities for cooperation and diversity are at least intriguing, and the Carista people will be pleased to know that ships under at least two present-day flags have both male and female crew members, end quote. So I think that's certainly interesting, and as we said, you know, funding is pretty much the major issue here, and Colin and I have joked about... you know, buying a military like a decommissioned military submarine or a decommissioned aircraft carrier or something like that to get like a temporary autonomous zone kind of free port going, which obviously that's kind of it's obviously a joke. I mean, how many of our listeners, you know, have the capital to buy a decommissioned aircraft carrier, you know, for the purpose of, you know, heavy industry? Probably not many. So I guess one solution by Carrie Thornley is, You know, get together with libertarians and do this. I mean, that kind of gets back to the collective movementist aspect. And also, too, I mean, I don't know, Jason. There are probably very few people that I would, you know, trust going into business with putting this much on the line, especially in the libertarian community. There's some sketchy people. There really are.
Yeah. I could, like, just off the top of my head, I can name, like, five or six maybe,
and I'm pretty sure we're probably thinking all the same five or six
probably. But yeah, this idea that that under a single company trademark each association could represent a different faction within the movement, come on. Like, we still got people arguing anarcho-capitalism versus anarcho-communism. I mean, the collective movement of anarchism is just as real as the collective movement of statism. Like, I don't see anarcho-capitalists coming together and anarcho-primitivists coming together and anarcho-communists coming together and going into business together.
No,
to each buy a
not.
Boat. No, I don't see it happening at all.
No, I certainly don't either. I think that's certainly, and a lot of these boats would have technology that anarcho-primitivists wouldn't want to use. So I mean, they'd be on the the image that is typically conjured of like an old pirate ship, That's what they would be selling with like cannonballs and such, and next to it would be the anarcho-capitalist ship with like with turrets and high technology stuff. Not turrets, but drones
keeping watch and
yeah, you get what I'm saying. I mean, I don't see that as being plausible, possible at all. But what I will say is, out there in international waters, on the open ocean, there could be. Sense, and this is something a syndicalist really should love. The open ocean, no one can really claim to the open ocean, right? You can't just the water underneath you is permanently changing, it's being moved, right? So you can't claim ownership to the water underneath you. You just can't do that. So the syndicalist should like that, and obviously the anarcho-capitalist, the free market proprietarian anarchists should be fine with that too. There's no government; you can conduct all the business you want to. So
agorist, yep. Where are you?
Yep. So and that was one interesting thing about the Marinilla project, was something Bob Llewellyn brought up a number of times, that you could have. So Marinilla would just be that like that floating hotel, and later down the road it would be kind of like a marina where like the port would be, and then everyone else would either they'd have their own very advanced houses on the water, or they would just have their boats. And you could see, Marinilla there. You could have, an anarcho-capitalist kind of, voluntary floating permanent associate, or I guess a permanent floating voluntary community there, close to Marinilla. You could have the syndicalist variety. Like, you could have those folks, in the same area, but going as far as to say that, all right, let's get the syndicalists, the primitivists, the anarcho-capitalists. Let's get all these folks together. Let's get a single company trademark and let's start moving goods.
Herding cats. That's what you're talking about. Herding cats on open water. I love the idea. I'm a big fan of Carl Hess. I love the idea. I'm anarchism without hyphens. But you're not gonna herd cats on the open ocean.
Right. Oh, man. So it's continuing on. We've got about a paragraph left here, and this is an interesting one here. Quote, finally, should the day ever come that agoric shipping lines or whatever would decide to be done altogether with the political powers of the world, many existing merchant ships, including all those built with U.S. subsidy money, are especially made for quick conversion to fighting status, so it would not be the usual matter of armed government goons saying to unarmed businessmen, come, let us reason together, end quote, Kerry Thornley. So is he saying there, let me reread this again, are especially made for quick conversion to fighting status, so it would not be the usual matter of armed government goons saying to unarmed businessmen, come let us reason together. Is he saying that, obviously we mentioned decommissioned aircraft carriers and things, right? I mentioned that just a moment ago. Is he saying that these ships could defend themselves against the state? Or am I getting this wrong here?
I believe that is what he's saying.
God.
I don't. So now we're herding cats, and we're gonna have
an all-out war with the state.
An all-out war against the state.
The only way that this could be okay. So I'll bring in Erwin Strauss again. How to Start Your Own Country. Highly recommend that book. You can get it for free online. Just Google Erwin Strauss, How to Start Your Own Country. You can get a PDF of it. Highly recommend it. Again, when it comes to starting libertarian countries, whether the Free Society Foundation route, Roger Ver, or whether it is something like Marinilla. I agree with Erwin Strauss here, and I don't think it's a violation of the non-aggression principle. I think the only way for it to survive is by the acquisition of nuclear weapons or weapons of mass destruction. I don't like it. I really don't. But if we're being practical here, realistic, that's the only way that a new libertarian country with limited funding and limited individuals could defend themselves against the state, and it's not a surefire way that it would work. But I think that's really the only way, and I don't like it. I really don't. But I think Roger Ver is wrong in saying that's a violation of the non-aggression principle. But regardless, what do you think?
I do not believe that having said weapons is a violation, but I do very much believe that being willing to use them is. I mean, when you're talking about using a weapon of mass destruction like an atomic bomb or whatever else. You're not just going to hurt the person that's threatening you, right? I mean, only individuals act, correct? Right? So if when we dropped the bomb, or when we, quote unquote, when the U.S. government dropped the bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, they weren't targeting the people threatening them, right? They weren't targeting the military. They were targeting civilian population. They killed like tens of thousands of civilians, of non-combatants, right, of people that had never even, you know, looked in the direction of the United States, have never even, you know, uttered the words, and just off the map. I mean, I'm not a fan, not at all.
Right. No, I'm right there with you. And I really do love the way that Erwin Strauss discusses this. It's a matter of fact. He doesn't lay out his opinion. He just says, here's what I believe, or I guess it is his opinion, but he hasn't placed, I guess, his moral judgments on it. He just says, you know, this is in order for this to be successful. And he was the authority on the subject. I don't mean authority like the state. Like he was the guy that was involved with a lot of these new libertarian country projects. But he said, quote, now some new country organizers some new country organizers will recoil at the thought of inflicting large numbers of casualties. But the fact is that war and the inflicting of such number of casualties lies at the heart of statecraft, and he who has no stomach for it needs to look for another line of work. The only way that a nation or country can avoid having to inflict such casualties is to convince all that it is ready and willing to inflict them, end quote. So as you're well aware, Jason, the solutions I'm seeking out are, you know, like Van Nomadism as possibility, homesteading, you know, looking more like it'll come into fruition sooner than I thought. You know, I go for these kind of individual strategies. I don't want to rely on other people. But the point is, and I think Erwin Strauss is correct here. If you're going to be starting a new country, and Roger Ver, just because it's not a country, that's what everyone else will see it as. It's a statist. This is a part of statecraft, right? How do states and countries retain their territory? How do they do that, Jason? They do it through violence.
Through violence. So
if you're going to enter this line of work and you want to be successful, it's like entering into a football game and thinking you don't have to play by the rules that the NFL lays out. It doesn't make sense, right? Now maybe there's some ways around that. I don't know, but still, the point is that if any new libertarian country wants to survive, then I don't see how it's feasible without that sort of a threat. And obviously the goal would be never having to use them. But if the country wants to survive, that it is ready and willing to inflict them, as Erwin Strauss said. Now, Jason, I hate that. I do. I'm just kind of laying out what Erwin Strauss said. You know, if this is going to be successful, then all right, folks, what are you going to do about this massive problem known as the state, right? Because I've looked into the various case studies in the past, and you know, the lack of defense is a major issue. It really is, right? So, not saying I like this. I'm just laying it out kind of matter of fact, like Erwin Strauss did.
Absolutely. Self-defense, right? Self-defense is a human right. We all understand that. But what we're talking about here is not individual human right to self-defense. What we're talking about is the collectivist country's right to self-defense, right? And as libertarians are so proud to peacock again and again and again, only individuals act. Well, when you have a libertarian country that is not only willing but is able to defend itself with a nuclear weapon, blah 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 blah, the state, the country that you're taking the land from, I mean, if we're talking like out on the open ocean, that's an entirely different story, but we're talking, you know, like Liberland, like we talked about before, Liberland's in the middle of two countries, right? Both of those countries have the ability to just walk in and wipe that country out. If the country of Liberland doesn't have the ability to defend itself from these two Goliaths, then it's not going to last, because eventually one of those two countries is going to get pissed off and just wipe them off the map.
Eventually, yeah, I completely agree with you, and I can't remember where I read this, so just take this for, you know, you and also the listeners, take this for a grain of salt, but what I heard about Libreland, why, I don't remember the two countries either, but why these two countries aren't doing much about it is that they, both of the countries really don't care about that land. But it's a swamp. And as Erwin Strauss said, the goal of nation states and countries is to keep the number of countries down so they can control the game. They don't care about that land, but what they care about is that there's a supposed new country. They aren't going to recognize it, called Libreland. They aren't going to recognize it, but at the same time, you know, they're quarreling over who actually owns that. And there's another territory that they both lay claim to that's more important to them. So I read that somewhere, and I don't recall where I did. I really wish I did, but there's a very good reason why neither of those countries has just gone in and taken it over, and I think it's a dispute over some other territory. I guess I'll just kind of you know, leave it at that. You know, these new country projects, you know, we mentioned before, you know, the lack of funding in the libertarian community, libertarian anarchists, and even Vinuan community too. But Vinuans don't really care about, you know, that lack of funding in these projects, because it doesn't cost much to be a Vinuan. But regardless, the lack of funding is a major problem. A lot of folks, you know, may like some idea like that, but it's tough to uproot your entire life, and especially if you have a family and kids, things like that. That's a major, major change, and a lot of folks, you know, are unable to uproot their entire lives to go live on some new libertarian country, whether it's on the water or not. That would be number two, and also number three is just the state. We've been kind of talking about that for the past, you know, 10 or 15 minutes or so, and that's a major, major issue. And that's, I really do think that's going to be the major reason why none of these things will really ever come into fruition. Now, I hope I'm wrong on that, but at the same time, we've been talking about what nation states do and how they retain their power. And yeah, unless a libertarian new country is willing to do the same thing, then they're not going to exist. They're just not going to. Unless it's, I guess the only possible other solution would be, like, say, Roger Ver and the Free Society Foundation, you know, do make some agreement with the government. And they do make some agreement with the government. Why would that nation state or government just outright sell that land? I'm guessing what will happen is there will be like a 99-year lease, and they'll be given kind of like an exclusive economic zone, kind of like Hong Kong used to have. And they'll build up all that infrastructure, and you know, it'll be a very, very profitable place. And then I just imagine the abutting country, the selling country, will just take it over, right? Because, you know, libertarians and anarchists, they hate war, and I hate war too. So could they really, I mean, you know, government's not stupid. I'm sure, you know, a lot of them have, you know, understand libertarianism at least some extent, maybe not, but I don't think they would take any, even if, you know, one of these libertarian countries had, you know, weapons of mass destruction or a nuke. I don't think they would take, you know, that threat very seriously, right? Because the last thing any, you know, person, any proprietarian anarchist, individualist anarchist would want to do, or would even, they would never advocate for that, right? You know, the detonation of a nuclear weapon. So I think even that might might be a problem. So yeah, I just don't see it, I don't see this really coming into fruition. We've kind of taken a little we haven't digressed, but we've gone beyond what Carrie Thornley said. But I'll turn it over to you. Do you have anything else there?
I just want to say that real quick, right? Any libertarian country that is willing to detonate a nuclear weapon or an atomic weapon of any kind is not a libertarian country, because they're not living up to libertarian values.
Yep. Ends means consistency, and, you know, function determines form. So, yeah. And this is, you know, that's why that's why I love Vanu so much, is it doesn't rely upon any of those things. You can live consistently and principled, and, you know, still increase your freedom or your invulnerability to coercion. So there's one footnote here that I want to read concluding this article. Carrie says, quote, "Now and again, one hears of war surplus liberty ships or something of that order for sale at less than $100,000. By the time such vessels are put in a sailing order, I have it on good authority, a fantastic monetary outlay would be needed. I have not priced ships extensively, but do know of one medium-sized tanker in bad condition that was valued at $400,000. Of new ships, those made in Japan are said to be among the most reasonable, and those built in the United States are exorbitant at no appreciable increase in quantity and quality, end quote. So $400,000 in 1966. So we're talking, you know, upwards of $1 million probably. So, I mean, the Free Society Foundation could buy one. And if they were really serious, Jason, they should be pursuing I don't want to, you know, put out. OK, this is my preference. Obviously, I'm not saying they should do anything like they not like not, no ought or should or anything like that. But if they were really serious, I think they would pursue, you know, freedom on the open ocean instead. They would have, you know, taken heed of Erwin Strauss's words back in 1967 or 1970 or whenever that book was published. But yeah, I guess that's we're talking about a lot of money here. A lot of money here.
A heck of a lot of money. I'm actually trying to look it up right now on the dollar times inflation calculator. Let's see.
Go for it. Yeah.
Okay, $400,000 in 1966 has the same buy-in value as $3,036,880 in 2017.
Wow, so inflation. I'm not surprised that inflation has, you know, been that bad, but, you know, I was thinking, you know, twice as much as reasonable. Shit.
Annual inflation over this period was about 4.05%.
All right, wow.
So, right. Yeah.
All right, let's get forward here. We'll get more into I think we'll return to that discussion here after this one. But chapter 4, Marine Cities, quote: In Japan, a restaurant has been planned under the ocean where patrons can watch the fish and vice versa. And perhaps it won't be long before some enterprising American built a resort hotel nestled 12 fathoms deep on the pure white sand of a reef valley and hemmed in on all sides by tumbling gardens of coral and the constantly changing multicolored life of the sea, end quote, the bountiful sea. There's actually, I watched a video of one of these. There's room or rooms, plural, that you can actually rent that are underneath the ocean. I don't remember where, maybe Fiji or somewhere like that, but I watched a video of it and it's badass. You lay there on the bed and you can just see fish swimming around you. Like, it's awesome. But yeah, that didn't happen. That wasn't there in 1966, but yeah, that does exist now.
Yeah, that would be absolutely just fantastic to.
It costs like £5,500 a night though, so I don't know what that would translate. Like we're talking at least $5,000 a night, so it's pretty expensive. I mean, that's a lot of money.
Well, yeah, the overhead would be tremendous.
Right, I don't even know how you would go about doing that, but I'm not an engineer, so I guess that makes sense, right?
All right, hey, there's one in Florida, according to this. Let's see. Zanzibar. Let's see. Where's some of the other ones? Maldives. Sweden has one. I don't know. Key Largo, Florida. Depth of 30 feet. That's $800 a night.
Hell, that's reasonable.
One in the Fiji at 40 feet, and it's only $30,000 a week for the couple.
I think that's the one I was talking about.
And there's one in Dubai, which 65 feet deep, and they do not list a price, so you can bet it's expensive.
Right, right. So yeah, those things definitely do exist. But let's see what Mr. Kerry Thornley, ex-associate of Lee Harvey Oswald, has to say about this. Quote. I had to bring that up again. Quote, many previous issues of Innovator have contained reports on the pirate industries of the North Sea, commercial endeavors which do not pay protection money to the governments of Europe since they are located outside the territorial boundaries of some, as defined by international law. As the food, mineral, and living space potential of the sea come more under the control of technology, enterprises of this nature increase in number on continental shelf areas all over the world, end quote. So something I don't have anything specific there to talk about, but the question I have, let's see here. So the question I have is, right, let me back up and provide some context here. If, you know, underground underwater hotels become like a thing, you know, like they become, you know, as the technology becomes cheaper and it becomes more widely available, I wonder if, you know, those would still fall under the same regulations and taxation as, you know, an above ground hotel on, you know, like an island. Now, to answer my question, to a certain extent, I guess it would depend upon whether they were in the contiguous zone, which they probably would be. I would imagine up to that, 27 miles off of the coast. I mean, it's been a while since I've looked into that. 27 miles off of the coast of an existing government. If it's within the contiguous zone, there are some regulatory powers, but I don't think they... It is kind of open-ended, though, so maybe they would fall under the same taxation powers. But if for some reason, you know, if there is a legal interstice there, Jason, where these underground hotels or these underwater hotels would lie outside of that realm, you know, those might become a lot more feasible in the near future, you know, price-wise.
Oh, not only price-wise, but as technology advances and as structural engineering advances and as the ability to live off the grid advances, right? The technological ability to live off the grid advances, the plausibility of an underwater hotel or an underwater home greatly increases, in my opinion. You know, once you have the structural engineering down of it, and the structural engineering in order to create a dome, you know, for lack of a better example, like Sandy Cheeks on SpongeBob, she lives in an air dome, right? Once you have the ability to do that, then theoretically the possibilities of even like farming under the water, you know, in this
living
this
underwater.
Air dome. Living under the water, farming under the water, you know, you can do with grow lights and things like that. Like, you don't actually have to have sunlight. You can use ultraviolet lights and grow lights and things like that. And you could theoretically be completely self-sustainable in your underwater.
Utilizing ocean thermal energy conversion or the waves for your power. Holy hell. But Jason, yep. you really used a SpongeBob example in the Vonnie podcast. I don't know how I feel about that.
I have kids. I've watched a lot of SpongeBob.
I'm just giving you shit. But all right. Let's see here. What's up?
I'll hand in my anarchist membership card.
Your Vanuan membership card.
My Vanuan membership card? Okay.
All right, let's get back to it. Quote, farming the sea for both fish and edible seaweed is emerging from the experimental stage. Some 20% of Japan's coal is mined from beneath the ocean floor, and countless other pilot mining projects for every mineral imaginable are underway around the globe. The bottom of the sea is also already a widely recognized storage place. One U.S. city stores its water supply beneath its harbor, and fuel has been stored successfully by the U.S. Navy in the Gulf of Mexico. The prospect of sea cities on and under the surface is now taken for granted by informed prognosticators, and the prospect is immediate. There are two ways libertarians can take advantage of these developments. One, focus educational efforts on the men and women who are involved in these projects. Meet and become acquainted with ocean frontiersmen. Think how handy such friends might be in an economic or political crisis. Ask them many questions. Find out what their professional problems are and suggest solutions that are in accord with their libertarian principles. Inform them of their rights above the law. Tell them how to foil the statist mentality and defeat the expansionist efforts of the national bureaucracies. These are things you can do no matter where you live. The marine biology professor at a Midwest college is as much part of what is virtually a second industrial revolution as the hypothetical enterprising American who builds a resort 12 fathoms down. And if you live in an Arizona ghost town, you can still write letters or even newspaper columns. Demonstrate to the marine pioneer that his prime advantage is the long tradition of freedom of the high seas, and that it will be personally profitable to him if he does all that is within his power to maintain it, end quote. Now, I did kind of, I guess, educational efforts. I don't like educational efforts all that much. I guess some people could argue that the Vonnie podcast is an educational effort, but at the same time, it's not educating people on, you know, free market economics. I'm not saying any of those things are bad, but action, guys. You know, education's been happening, you know, since Fee was founded back in like the 1940s by Leonard Reed. So, or not Leonard Reed, the author of I, Pencil, whatever the hell his name was. Is it Leonard? No. He has a son. I get confused between them. But regardless, educational efforts have been going on for a long time. It's time for action. But as far as, you know, what he had to say there, I mean, do you have any thoughts?
No, I agree exactly with what you said. I mean, education is fine, but it doesn't it doesn't get you anywhere. You know, it's just spinning wheels.
Right, right. Now, I do agree. You know, if there are any, like the, there was apparently going to be a consultant, like a structural engineer or something along those lines, or an oceanic engineer, if that is a thing. I think that might have been kind of the label. There was a guy at the Marinilla Project, some sort of scientist. You know, I don't see anything bad about, you know, becoming acquainted with those folks and, you know, teaching each other. I certainly don't see anything bad about that. But, you know, kind of, you know, focusing on the educational efforts on this. I mean, this is, I don't know. I think there's some interesting ideas, but I don't know. I don't know. What, anything else there?
No, nothing else.
Kind of a dull point. I'm kind of disappointed. But anyways, quote, concentrate investment of resources on maritime metropolis projects, particularly on man-made floating islands and other highly mobile capital, since this can be defended against future attempts at control or confiscation by the world powers. And quote, I'm going to stop there. Yes, I like, yes, temporary autonomous zones. This is one thing. If there is, like, if a free port, you know, if a libertarian, anarchist, Venuan free port were to exist, and exist successfully outside of, you know, the realm of, you know, regulatory or nation state powers, I do think it would have to be a temporary autonomous zone, such as, again, for any of you guys that have the money for a decommissioned aircraft carrier, you know, get one of those and just have, like, you know, have it be a mobile free port. So, you put out a tweet and you say, all right, the Agora carrier or the Agora market will be in international waters located, you know, this latitude and longitude or this nautical mile distance from whatever destination. Come out and buy and sell weed and drugs and all that sort of stuff, or whatever the hell would be, you know, bought and sold, or just, you know, legal things outside of, you know, untaxed and unregulated. That would be very feasible because you could just pick up and leave, right? You wouldn't be relegated to a certain geographical location. So I think that's a very, very fantastic idea, and I salute Carrie Thornley in the non-status way for that suggestion.
Well, absolutely. Just to continue on that point, I looked into this a little bit, right? The ability to create a man-made floating island, and those blue plastic 55-gallon barrels. Put a plug on it, and each one of those barrels will hold 459 pounds while floating, right? So if you were to get 10 of those and a couple sheets of plywood, that sheet of plywood, you know, you're going to be able to hold 4,500 pounds. So if you got your boat out there, throw some barrels down, throw a sheet of plywood onto it, secure it, bam, instant floating island. You got your own little anarchy island there to do whatever business you need to do, and then pack it up and bring it home, or, you know, ship it or tow it somewhere else, or do whatever you need. It's entirely possible to do a man-made floating island. Pontoon boats. Yes. Pontoon boats do it all the time.
Right, right. Yeah, and that's I'm glad you found out the specific you know, measurements of that. But and you can get those things for a lot of times for free, man. I know the dock we have down there at our property in Southern Illinois is held up by those things. So and I think we got a lot of those for free. You know, you could do it pretty cheaply, I would say. Maybe we just got lucky. I don't know how often those are given away for free, but regardless, I mean, yeah, that's certainly a possibility. And I will mention, So 4 years ago, we went to Isla Mujeres, which is off of Cancun. It's an island of women. It's not as crazy as you think it would be. No, it was a lot of old people, but it was still a great experience. Everyone drove around on golf carts, and the bludgies there. Everyone drove around on golf carts, and everyone drank on the golf carts. So, like, the bludgie would just sit there and, like, wave at you. Like, that was like, okay, like, funded by taxation, but cheers, mate. Anyways, there was one guy who, and this is kind of a tourist attraction. He's interviewed. You can find interviews with him on YouTube. But he actually built a man-made island out of plastic, you know, out of trash plastic bottles, and the, I guess, the vegetation, you know, in the lake, you know, grew up around it, and it's actually a very stable platform. So an artificial island, and it was off grid too. I mean, he had a solar panel out there, and you could actually go on there, and you could actually go get a tour of his place. Fortunately, he wasn't there whenever we meandered on down there, but. At the same time, it was cool as shit to look at. And in one of the interviews I saw, he wanted to move it out more so he wanted to, you know, tow it out into kind of the ocean. And I was like, that'd be pretty neat. I don't know if he actually ever did it, but very interesting little story. There are a lot of ways to construct these man-made islands, these artificial islands. So I think it's plausible, man. I really do. Yeah,
it's entirely possible. I mean, as you said, he had a solar panel, right? I mean, that's if you have flotation and a solar panel, beyond that, there's so many things you can do if you have the power, right? Through the solar panels. I mean, you can set up like an electric motor. I mean, to move your little island. I mean, you can set up, you know, electric desalinization plants you can set up like a hydroponic system with automatic watering, whatever. There's a lot of things that you can do with just super basic, available technology.
Right. No, I certainly agree. So the main point I wanted to make there was temporary autonomous zones. You know, Rayo saw a lot of value in mobility, which is why he first pursued van nomadism. If the coercers can't find you, they can't coerce you. And why he chose Wilderness Vonnegut and had various different squat spots, or not squat spots, but he had various different Vonnegut home bases. So mobility is definitely important. I think Kerry's right on point here. He was an editor of Innovator and a friend of Rayo's, so I guess that doesn't really surprise us at all. But anyways, quote. Another possibility that should not be entirely ignored, though, is the bubble on the bottom concept, especially as a means of hiding large quantities of property. Construction costs are often less, and protection from storms is usually superior. Nor are monetary resources all that can be invested. A student entering the university can direct his studies toward aspects of the oceanic scene, in most cases with little or no shift in his field of interest. The student of law, for example, can specialize in maritime and international law. The engineer can focus on marine engineering, etc. Servicing and communications industries will also have a market in marine communities. A private sea air postal system and a few libertarian-edited marine industrial journals might get things off to a good start. Future articles in this series will report on specific commercial activities, which are now thriving in salt water, many of which are probably on the sites of the free cities of tomorrow's voluntary world. End quote, Kerry Thornley. So yeah, I guess the main points here, you know, storing stuff in the ocean. Okay.
Sandy's bubble. Sandy's dome. SpongeBob.
Two SpongeBob references in one episode. It's okay. Yeah, as far as those other things, if someone's going to be in a high-level indoctrination, you know, focus your studies on more, I guess, the ocean variety. And if you're going to be going to law, I don't recommend this one. No. I don't. The lawyers are the ones that wrote the laws for the police state. They were the ones that created the fourth branch of government, the administrative agencies, the National Security Agency, and all of those other terrible, terrible agencies. That are the judge, jury, and executioner on their own right, so to speak. So yeah, I mean, Vanuatu, no, I'll go ahead and just say that in my opinion, there's no such thing as a Vanuatu lawyer. If he still has his bar card and he still practices.
Oh, absolutely not. If you are a Vanuatu, then you do not believe in an appeal to authority. That's exactly what the law is. If you specialize in maritime and international law, if you're a law, if you're dealing with the law at all, if you're trying to, you know, court cases and all that, it's an appeal to authority, right? You are asking the government. You're trying to fight the government through legal means to win your freedom, and that is an appeal to authority. You're asking the government to allow you to be free.
You're subservient to them. If you do something they don't want you to, they can always strip away your bar card. I don't like that little suggestion. Now, if there is ever a circumstance where a lawyer was needed, I'd say outsource that. you know, just contract that out if it's ever necessary, which I don't know. I can't think of any instances where it would be, but regardless, I don't recommend any Venuans. If there are any 18-year-old Venuans listening, please don't take that suggestion seriously and just, okay, well, I'm just going to go into international and admiralty law then. That's what I'm going to do for my high-level indoctrination pursuit. No, please, I guess, do what you want to, but it's not something we'd recommend. If you're pursuing Venuans and you've listened to all the episodes, it should be very, very clear why that would be a bad strategy. But anything else?
Yeah, one more point I wanted to make. The idea of specializing towards an education. As we talked about earlier with the different ships under the same, you know, copyright code or limited liability, whatever, LLC. The idea of specializing can be both good and bad, right? If you specialize in engineering, right? Well, if you specialize in engineering, right, well, maybe you're going to lack somewhere else. You know, if you specialize in you know, growing food on the ocean, well, you're going to lack in something else. So I don't – unless you have a party and each person specializes in one thing, gears it toward the party itself, you know, to make the party itself better – then I can make an argument for it. But I do not believe in specializing. I believe in being a jack of all resources, right? Yep. Knowledge weighs nothing, right? That's something that they teach you in survivalism a lot is knowledge weighs nothing. If you know how to do a large variety of things well, you're a lot better off than if you know how to do one thing very, very well.
Right. And say this is a Vanu association here, and you have, you know, maybe say 10 people, and you each have your specialties, and that's kind of what you focus on. That's how you trade, barter, all of those good things. Well, what if your boat repairsman dies? What Yes. are you going to do? So I think a better way to do this, and I think Derek Bros in the Houston Free Think, or I guess maybe in their Freedom Cell group, they do this, but the idea, so yeah, I mean, I have my specialties, Jason, you have your specialties. You know, if we are in a Freedom Cell or Vanu Association, I think the best route to go would be we teach each other our specialties, and we all are able to do everything, so that unfortunately, if John dies and he's our farmer, right? He's the one that you know, understands all that stuff. So if he dies, unfortunately, we can still, you know, keep doing what we're doing. We can, you know, division of labor and all, we know what he's doing, and we can kind of take over there. So, I'm right there with you. You know, having a specialty is good, but at the same time, I think, you know, being able to do a lot of things is certainly preferred.
Oh, absolutely. Being able to cross train people and knowing a large variety of things, it's not only knowing how to do different things, but like if you specialize in one thing, then you're going to get stuck in that one thing, you know. And if your voluntary association group falls apart or whatever else, well, now you are stuck again knowing only this one thing, and that's the niche that you can assert yourself in another group. But if you're cross-trained, then you have a large variety of skills, and you can insert yourself into another group wherever they need the help.
Right. I guess one final point, you know, having those. So say I'm an electrician and you're an engineer. You know, if we kind of stay off to our own sides, you know, we could probably be efficient on ourselves. But when you combine in like electrical engineering, you know, that could also, you know, further the technology in the Vanu Association too. So if I think Daryl Becker used this reference, you know, when people specialize in things, they're at the top of this mountain peak, and I'm probably gonna, you know, put this badly, but they're at the top of their mountain peak, and they really don't know what anyone else is doing. So being it like, you know, furthering, you know, the technological capabilities of a Vanu Association would certainly, I think, you know, cross-specializing might be a better way to put it, cross-specializing in various things and combining, you know, all of these things to I guess, provide a better Vanu Association. All right. So chapter 5, aquaculture. Quote, control of foodstuffs in the sea has a beginning similar to that of its counterpart of land. Start with the weeds. When the weeds become cultured, we call them plants. Once culture takes hold, then yield accelerates, and we have more than enough for our immediate needs. End quote. Robert M. Snyder. Aquaculture. Quote, Japan is the world's leading nation when it comes to farming the sea. Over 20 kinds of sea plant, for example, are marketed there for eating purposes. Some of these are harvested wild, but many are cultivated from seed, transplanted to oceanic nets, and harvested about 2 months later. They are then dried on sheets on bamboo mats. This end product, while it usually requires the Occidental that he develop a taste for it, is rich in vitamins and very popular with the natives of Japan. In 1954, Dr. Matsusaku opened the first commercial shrimp farms in Japan. 9 years later, he was shipping 70 pounds of shrimp per day. He has bred shrimp up to 8 inches in length, and he is also breeding prawns, a total of 2,860 pounds in 1961, 500 tons in 1962, and more than 1,000 tons in 1963. Another popular oriental food is a shellfish called the wreath shell. These have been artificially inseminated in a single batch of 200,000 eggs produced per insemination. The Japanese also suspend racks from floats and grow oysters upon them in quantities of about 20,000 tons per year, and about 2,200 tons of eels are harvested each year on over 750 eel farms. In addition, bream, blowfish, bass, halibut, and gray mullet are also bred by fish ranchers. And when the market is bad, there are fatteners who will buy a part of a fish crop to retain in holding tanks for speculative purposes. The market is open for the ambitious entrepreneur who is ready to stake out his claim and start farming somewhere beyond the three-mile-long arms of the land-going pirates of our time, end quote, Kerry Thornley. So, I mean, he's right. I mean, as far as, you know, food production in the open ocean, man, there are a lot of possibilities.
Absolutely. We do this here in the United States a lot. With the clams and shellfish and salmon is a big thing now. I want to call it like a controlled growth is really what it is. You know, they're not going out and fishing these things as much as planting them and growing them on their own. They just happen to be growing them in the ocean.
Right. Yeah. Well, exactly. And one of the things with the Marinilla project, this would be one of the, you know, again, I mentioned earlier that it's been a while ago, so I'll repeat it. One of the things I liked about the Marinilla project is after that initial $50 million investment in the floating hotel, there were a lot of profitable ventures that could be undertaken there in the open ocean. One of those things was, you know, fish farming. And I'm guessing a lot of these things that were discussed in you know, this chapter five, aquaculture, I'm sure a lot of those things could be pursued as well. So, I mean, yeah, there are a lot of possibilities. And, you know, a lot of entrepreneurs are already pursuing these routes. But, you know, as far as funding for a libertarian project, you know, it's always a problem, as we've been saying over and over again. You know, that could be one interesting route for new country builders or I guess freeport builders or whatever you want to call them. All right, so that was chapter five. Not a whole lot to mention there, but chapter six, marine mining, and we're almost done, guys. It's a 2-hour episode, which is all right. But quote, undersea mining in some areas is already big business. Magnesium is extracted directly from seawater. Oil and sulfur have been taken from beneath the seafloor for many years. The ocean is already being opened up for commerce, and before long, private industry will be spending more on undersea commerce than government now spends on undersea warfare. End quote. So let me just... Okay, and for the sake of time, pretty much what Kerry Thornley does here is just go through, you know, all of the mining operations that are taking place on the ocean floor, you know, for whatever, you know, gems or whatever is down there, gems, oil, you know, whatever it is. I don't think we need to read this article, Jason. Just, you know, some possible mining, you know, potentials or potential for, you know, libertarian entrepreneurs. But again, like this is kind of heavy industry stuff. I mean, it costs a lot to open an oil rig. It costs a lot to deep sea drill for, you know, whatever element you're looking to get. So I don't know how valuable it would be to kind of read this entire proposal from Kerry Thornley. What do you think?
No, it's big business company after big business company after big business company. I don't really see. I mean, there's a little piece about Aqualandia that might be interesting.
Yep. I know. I just looked at that part. Yeah, that'll be interesting. So yeah, we'll cover this part real quick. So, quote, the first claim theory, for example, as some prominent libertarians espouse it, would put most future marine mineral exploitation under the control of an aspiring monarchy, which calls itself Aqualandia. For His Majesty King Marian I, in a proclamation dated 10th August 1961, published a claim to all the lands of the world that exist beneath the oceans and other saltwater bodies of the world, except that portion of ocean bottom or other saltwater bottom lands, which are now claimed as the property of the various government in the world, and where such claim is, as of this date, recognized as valid by international law. The proclamation goes on to assure that Aqualandia does not claim any right to govern, regulate, or interfere with the present or future use of the waters above its land, and adds that Aqualandia is patterned after that of England. This proclamation was published in a pamphlet called The Aqualandian in July of 1966, but somehow I fail to see, speaking only for myself, how recognition of this first claim, if indeed it is the first, would possibly be in my interest. On the other hand, the standard argument of the most ardent admirers of Henry George, which hold that natural resources should not be claimed by individuals or companies or societies at all, but should be owned in common and at best a sort of universal profit-sharing plan, and which would tend to condemn the present companies involved in ocean mining for coercively monopolizing the mineral deposits, while certainly more rational than the unmodified first claim theory, brings up a host of new problems in its place, and putting aside those which fall into the who would administrate category entirely, this approach would, unless liberalized, go counter to our primary purpose of winning over to the libertarian position those basic industries now mining the seas. Quote, one factor which may bring about a resolution, at least with regard to the ocean, is the technical difficulties involved. By the time one has extracted minerals of almost any sort from the sea, a great deal of thought and energy has been applied. It is far more difficult than driving a claim post into the ground or panning gold. Arbitrary first claims on behalf of Southern California groups and their will and their like will tend to be ignored and will be next to impossible to enforce. And the Georgists, if they can point out to the mining companies a self-interested motive for voluntarily paying out mineral rent fees to the population at large, will find little opposition from laissez-faire libertarians. In the meantime, it is important that the rest of us develop a rational and simple procedure for establishing ownership of the natural resources in the sea, perhaps along the lines of John Locke's mixing labor formula, end quote, Kerry Thornley. Now, hold on one second. Let me reread one portion here, just for my purposes and maybe for some of the listeners too. Quote, and the Georgists, if they can point out to the mining companies a self-interested motive for voluntarily paying out mineral rent fees to the population at large, we'll find little opposition from laissez-faire libertarians. So what he's kind of discussing here is, you know, how I mentioned earlier that you can't really lay claim to, you know, the water, right? You really can't, because, you know, it's constantly changing, right? So you can't really lay claim to the water, but claims of property could be made on the minerals on the ocean floor. So I guess as the Georgists would point out, you know, mineral rent fees to the population at large I don't know if I like that either. I mean, it would mean that the ocean floor belongs to everybody, and that's very communistic in my opinion.
Yeah, very collectivist. Yeah. This would be a fantastic philosophical discussion, right? As we talked about, you can't own the water because water is constantly moving. So you can't say I own from X to X, blah, blah, blah. The ocean floor, which is technically not water, it's technically solid ground. It just happens to be underwater. Can one homestead the ocean floor? And if one can homestead the ocean floor, don't they own the minerals that are within the boundaries of their homestead the same as they would, you know, in Oregon or Colorado or Texas? Yep.
In my opinion, yes. Yes. So when individuals begin to homestead the ocean floor, they build their houses on there, they start their aquaculture farms or whatever. I would say, as far as the ocean floor, yeah, I would say so. I mean, that's what, from a propertarian anarchist perspective, that makes sense. But let me posit this question to you, Jason. So since that's not happening, right, people aren't homesteading the ocean floor, I mean, I think this is certainly an interesting, you know, discussion, and maybe something that, you know, maybe me, you, and Kyle should get together to talk about. I guess it'd be more philosophical discussion as far as ownership of the ocean floor and the minerals thereof. But I guess since people are not homesteading the ocean yet, where does that leave the minerals? I mean, it basically, as of right now, it just leaves it to, you know, whatever government's going to, or, you know, whatever, you know, oil corporation is going to lobby the government enough to get permission to drill off the coast of Florida or wherever it is, right? So I don't know. Yeah. What do you think?
Well, if I got to go back to the land on this. I mean, if nobody claims the land, then the minerals or whatever goods can be gotten off the floor are unclaimed, right? I mean, just as the berry bush on the unclaimed land is for whoever comes across it, right?
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
All right. If nobody owns the land that the berry bush is on, then whoever comes and picks the berries gets them first. I feel it would be the same way with the ocean floor.
Right. Right. You know, I certainly agree. I certainly agree. So I guess the point here is that, you know, any of those oil contracts granted by the state, you know, all of that is obviously just as with, say, federal lands, so-called, or public lands. You know, it's all unclaimed property, you know, ready to be homesteaded. So, I agree with you, man. I agree with you. But, yeah, anything else on that one?
No, I think we covered it with that last little exchange there. Like to lay claim, I mean, Aqualandia is a fantastic theoretical and again, it's a fantastic theoretical discussion, but again, it as recognized by international law, bam, appeal to authority again. If you're appealing to authority, then you're recognizing the state. If you're recognizing government and things like that, then you're not practicing VANU if you're trying to use their laws for your advantage because you're exposing yourself to the coercion. You're not trying to exercise freedom. You're trying to exercise the state.
Right, right. And I feel like I should make a distinction here. Exercising, you know, utilizing legal exercises is different than the appealing to authority that Jason's referring to here. But I know exactly what you mean. But it's interesting. I would recommend Erwin Strauss's book. I'll mention it again, How to Start Your Own Country, just for the case history section. There have been a lot more, I guess, new country, model nation projects that have come about. And there have been at least a couple organizations or whatever that have. They laid arbitrary claim to every like the entire universe, you know, everything outside of the atmosphere of Earth. And then there, you know, as with Aqualand, I don't know, remember if that was a specific case study in Erwin Strauss's book, but there were those who claimed, jurisdiction over the entire ocean. Obviously, arbitrary claims, no one recognized them, but it's still kind of comical. And I'm guessing a lot of those were satire and obviously not serious, unless the individual is a psychopath, which is not outside the realm of possibility, right?
No, it's not outside the possibility at all.
God complex times 10 trillion.
Yeah, and then some.
Yeah, well, I guess 10 trillion to the 10 trillionth. Yeah. very good, very good. So, so yeah, you know, interesting, I guess, article series by Mr. Kerry Thornley. Again, you know, an associate of Lee Harvey Oswald. So I think the earlier articles are more practical. Again, you know, pursuing things on an individual basis and, you know, working with others when you can, I think is the best way to go. These grand collectivist schemes, they tend to fail. You know, they tend to fail for one reason or another, or they lead to concessions with the state, which is not good. Not good. So as far as kind of the earlier suggestions, you know, large boats and small boats. Yeah, I mean, for small boats, you're pursuing minimalist sailboating with a family member by yourself or with a family. Great. You know, that's very feasible. Very feasible with a large boat. If you want to do some, I guess, some profit making ventures aboard, I think that's practical too. You know, as long as you're not, as long as it's not, you know, aircraft carrier type or a decommissioned aircraft carrier type free port, that's very practical. And again, I do think a temporary autonomous zone, like a mobile free port, would be very plausible. But again, it just comes down to the initial capital investment necessary. And yeah, I don't think that one's very feasible. I think it could be done. I think without much concern, but other than the capital investment. But yeah, I guess that's kind of all I've got. Any closing thoughts, Jason?
No, I just like the voluntary floating society idea is absolutely fantastic, and it's very, very intriguing to me. It is philosophically and it is physically possible. The feasibility of it throws in a lot of questions, man. And, you know, until somebody has the capital to do it right, I don't believe it's going to happen. Sadly, I just don't believe it's going to happen.
And let me jump in there and kind of say, I think you're thinking more large scale. For small scale, like if it was say me, you, and you know seven other anarchists out there on a boat, you know that permanent floating voluntary society I think is very, very feasible. But yeah, large scale, you know, it's like a private city sort of thing on the water. I certainly agree with you.
That's what I was referencing. The large scale, you know, it's gonna attract so much attention, and when it attracts attention, it opens itself to coercion. Small scale, you know. A 26 foot boat, you know, 8 or 10 people. It's entirely possible. It's entirely possible. And then, as we talked about with the barrels and creating your own little floating island, it's entirely possible. I can't emphasize the possibility enough, especially with the technology that we have today, right? With the solar panels and being able to desalinate the seawater and the advancements in small scale farming that we know right now
wouldn't take hundreds of thousands of dollars either.
Oh, absolutely not. Absolutely not. I'm saying you could probably for a tenth of that, you know, for $20,000, I'm just off the top of my head, $20,000 to get the materials, to get the boat, put some elbow grease into the boat to make it what you need it. It's possible. It's not a lot of money, and that is cheaper than a new modern vehicle.
And certainly a modern lifestyle, say a Cervell Society lifestyle. Certainly. So anything else, man?
No, that was I'm tapped out on that one.
All right, cool. So I guess just to reiterate, if you want to purchase this when it's available for free, just go to tinyurl.com/boatfreedom. Or you can just go to vonipodcast.com/OFN and get the entire Ocean Freedom Notes publication, you know, with the permanent voluntary society issues or the articles in there. So yeah, the website is vonipodcast.com. Again, for the Vonnie podcast listeners, first time I've mentioned this, second time now, but first episode I've mentioned this, Liberty Under Attack, direct action over political crusading shirts. Obviously very related to Vonnie, and certainly a shirt that if anyone would be proud to rep. So libertyunderattack.com/shirts, small, large, and extra large is available. $15 and, you know, free shipping, and I'll send you some free goodies along with that. Cryptocurrencies, PayPal, all of that good stuff. But yeah, I guess that's all we've got for you. And hopefully next week, might be Jason and I again next week as far as the release. But you know, hopefully in the following episode we can get back to the. We're only like 3 or 4 episodes away from finishing season 2. I'm so excited for season 3, guys. We put together the first handful of episodes, and so this season will have maybe. By the time it's all said and done, maybe 20 episodes thereabouts. Season 3 is going to be the one that continues like into perpetuity, essentially. like for each of these episodes, when we're developing and modernizing Vonnie, you know, with the state how it is now and technology available. Kyle and I were talking. Vonnie and Cities will probably be like a 10-part series. Like, it's going to be pretty ridiculous in a good way. So you certainly have that to look forward to. Hopefully we can get back to, you know, I want to conclude season two already. So I'm sure you guys are ready to, you know, ready for us to make this practical again. So that said, FonniePodcast.com, and we'll talk to you next week.